Okay, so I'll introduce our speaker. So Betsy Wildhack is a native Arlingtonian, so same as me. She's involved in estate planning. She's an elder law attorney, and she's going to be talking about that sort of stuff today. She's licensed to practice in both Virginia and D.C., and we welcome her to Westminster to talk to us about estate planning and elder law and all of that fun stuff.
Woohoo! I can see why we got the thronging masses, because everybody likes to talk about their own death on a Sunday morning. Well, good morning. The reason we're in this, circular firing squad thing is I'm hoping that this is going to be more of a conversation than lecture. Although I will tell you, I'm a cradle Presbyterian. I come from a long line of Presbyterian ministers. My brother and his wife are both Presbyterian ministers. And their two children, my niece and nephew, one just graduated from Pittsburgh and is working at a church in Muscatine, Iowa. He's never seen that much flat before. And the other is in her final year at Columbia, in Decatur, Georgia. So, I feel like I have given my family to the church. So enjoy them. Please hire the children. it's funny when the kids, when my niece said she was going to seminary, I thought, somebody could make some money in this family. Someone other than me, right? I'm like, really? We paid for you to go to Vanderbilt so that you can really go, honey? So she's going to be the best educated, smartest. You're going to be so lucky to get her. Please pay her minimum wage. I have been practicing elder law and estate planning for about a little over 20 years. It is not at all what I thought I would do. I did not think that aging and death would be my business, but it turns out it's an amazingly interesting field, and I love it. I realize now, kind of looking back, that I was that kid at all the family gatherings who sat with, Great Aunt Emma and Great Aunt Sadie, and I wanted to hear the stories. And I've always, frankly, done better hanging out with older friends than with the kids my own age. My very dearest client was a lady named Wilma, and Wilma died just about 5 years ago. She was 11 days short of 105 years old. Sharp as a tack up until about 3 weeks before she died. And I know you want to know what everyone wanted to know. They would say to her, Wilma, what's the secret to living this long? And she would say, it's very easy. It's a whole lot of smoking and a lot of drinking. Just not in the last 80 years. It's very strange for me to be sitting down over here. So they asked me to come and talk to you a little bit about elder law. My friend Shirley Metzger was going to be here with me today. Shirley is a social worker who specializes in working with older folks to talk about cognitive issues. But apparently she had a chance to go on vacation instead of being here with us today. So, because what she would have talked to you about would be, among other things, the Montreal Cognitive Assessment Test, which is a test that I deal with all the time to help us figure out how people, it's a test of both memory and executive functioning. And it's only become well known quite recently because President Trump took the MCAT test, and his doctor said that that was proof of his cognitive intactness. And that made me giggle, because if you've ever taken this test, it's not really how you want to be assessing world leaders. This is a test that says, can you spell the word world backwards? Can you subtract 7 from 100. Can you do that again? I'm going to tell you 3 words, and 5 minutes from now I'm going to ask you those 3 words. So when you hear that MCAT, Montreal Cognitive thing, I'm not. This is not a political statement. This is about how things are reported. I'm not saying it's fake news. I'm saying sometimes we need to look a little bit farther into what we're being offered. Anyway, so first of all, I want to tell you let me ask this. Who here has a will? Yay. Who here thinks they don't? Great. So you do. You do. The legislature of Virginia wrote one for you. So if you everybody's got a will. It's whether you picked it or not. It's funny. I just took a case to the Virginia Supreme Court this year about the validity of somebody's will, because the signing of it was a little bit odd. And one of the things I learned through this process is that the law of wills is profoundly unchanged from 15th century England. Profoundly unchanged, except for the photocopier bit. And we have special... what I want to say is, if you want to make changes, since you guys all have your wills, please, please, please don't write on your will. Please don't do it. Send an email to your lawyer or get another piece of paper. I just went to the Virginia Supreme Court because this guy just decided to write all over his will. He wanted to make changes. His children were coming in and out of favor, as happens. And so, yes, sir.
Can you ask the follow-up question? If everyone raise their hands if they hit a row. How many are up to date? And I can't answer that in the
process. Is your will up to date? Yeah. Well, that's, you know, this one of the things I spend a lot of time with families in my office saying, but he promised me that. No, Dad said I could have that. No. Jimmy was supposed to get the beach house. Yeah, well, that's not what it says. Because, you know, it's funny. The only time the government cares about what you want, I mean, because right now they don't give a rat's patoot what you want, right? The only time they care about what you want is when you are dead. And when you're dead, like, well, you know, what did they mean? What was his intention? We have great phrases like, the testator, that's the guy who writes the will, the testator's intention is the lodestar. I love that. Honestly, it's the only time they care, and they spend a huge amount of time trying to figure out what it is that you meant. And then they're trying to figure out if it's what you meant or I just screwed up how I wrote it. You know, one of the things about writing wills is we type them now, but that's it. You know, it's just a document that I write. And so sometimes I don't capture exactly what you wanted, and sometimes I fat finger and put in a knot when I didn't mean to. And sometimes, my follow-up to what you've asked is your will up to date. Everybody ought to pull these things out every 3 to 5 years. Just look at them. Read them. They're not scary. They're not hard. Yeah. Well, they can be. Well, just look through the bolded names part. And, you know, I can't tell you, I get people coming in and they say, I think we need to update this. Why? Everyone we've named in here is already dead. Ha! That is a problem. That's a problem. Or people, I love, they come in and they go, I say, so last time you had your brother Bob as Bob. Oh my God, how did that happen? I mean, people are just amazed. You know, I do love that we work so hard on this stuff and you guys put it in a drawer and you never look at it again. And trust me, people, and I do have clients, it is their primary hobby to pull this stuff out and look at it. I have one lady who calls me like once a month and says, you know, I've been thinking, yes, what have we been thinking about now? One of the great things we did in Virginia some years ago is we got a provision included in the code that says for tangible stuff, stuff you can hold on to, that you can just make a list and you can update that list anytime you want and you do not have to come and see me for that. Thank you, Lord Jesus, because there are, honestly, I have clients that is their primary hobby. They update that list. I have this one client, great gal. She has pictures on the wall in her house like this. On the back of each picture, she has a color sticker. She has three kids, right? So she went to Staples. She's got blue, red, green. Behind each picture, she's put a sticker for one of her kids. The kids think that she doesn't know that when they come over, they move the stickers around. But she knows that they move the stickers around. So, but she doesn't really care, but some she puts back the way she wants it. And there's this one that everybody wants. And so she's now pasted an envelope on the back that says to be opened in the event of my death and has taped it down. And it's like, no, really, I mean, who gets this? One of the things I tell my clients, like in a case like that, please be the grown-up, make the decision. You know, I will tell you, I see families fighting over nonsense. And like in my family, my in-laws who live in Williamsburg are 90. He'll be 96 in April. She's 90. They have three daughters. They have two china cabinets. So for near on 30 years, I have begged them to get another china cabinet, or now get rid of one of the girls. And frankly, I don't care which one it is, right? I don't care. But there's going to be blood on the floor about the damn china cabinets. And every time now, my mother-in-law called last night, and I said, "Hi, Peg. Have you bought a china cabinet?" And she's like, "Betsy, I'm on dialysis 4 days a week. When do I have time to buy a china cabinet?" I'm like, would you like me to take care of that for you? Stop talking about this. No, I can't. Because guess who's got to clean that up? The other thing is your funeral arrangements. Like, Westminster Church is lovely. I'm sure that they do a lovely traditional Presbyterian service. However, what I can tell you is that if you have not, many people think they are clear on their wishes. Many people say, "I don't care what my funeral plans are." Pretend you care. Everybody just wants to do what you want them to do. And when you don't tell them, it's very frustrating. They're spinning their wheels, desperately trying to do something for you, and they can't figure out what to do. So the clearer you can be, and I'll tell you, I deal with hundreds of grieving families every year. Even if you don't care, just pretend you do care. Pick your hymns. Say where you want to be buried. There was a guy, gentleman who lived actually not too far from here. He was a Navy admiral, and his kids wanted to do the reading of the will. Now, it turns out that reading of the will in the lawyer's office is just a plot device for television and movies. We don't really do that. And I said, because, you know, usually if you want a copy of the will, I'll just email it to you. But in this case, all the kids were coming in. He was sufficiently high ranking that Arlington Cemetery had, you know, gotten it scheduled in the same calendar year. And they, so they had the morning, the service in the morning with the Riderless Horse and the band and the cake, and it was beautiful, beautiful. And then they came over to my office, and then later they were having this family gathering, this big reception. And so they want to do the reading of the will, and one of them brings it and hands it to me. And I open it up, and it says, I, Bob Smith, make this my last will and testament. It is my strongest desire that my bodily remains be cremated and the ashes spread off the back of the USS Enterprise on its next deployment. And I'm like, I don't want to read this aloud now, right? And, but I had to, and their faces, all these kids were like, so now what do we do? I was like, well, now you've learned a lesson about being really clear about what you want, right? Gee, Dad, thanks. So your will is not the place that people are going to look for that information. Just FYI, it's not the first place they look. They'll see it later, and then they'll be sorry. Which raises another interesting thing. Your body, your soul belongs to the Lord. However, your body belongs to your next of kin. And so in Virginia and most states, there's a whole body of law about who owns the body and who gets to make the decisions. And there was in Virginia some years ago a wrongful cremation case. So it was down in Newport News, Norfolk part of the state, and this guy, frequent flyer in the local emergency room, comes in and he dies. No one comes forward to claim the body. So who's in charge? Well, the sheriff. The sheriff is responsible for unclaimed bodies. So the hospital calls the sheriff. Sheriff calls local funeral home guy and says, got this unclaimed body. Can you take care of it for us? And the funeral home man says, not only will I do it, I will do it for free because I am a good citizen. All I want from you is a court order saying that you, sheriff, have the authority to authorize the cremation of this body. And he says, no problem. Sheriff goes to a judge. Judge signs the order. Everybody goes on their merry way. So the statute of limitations on stuff like that, I think, is whether it's 2, 3 years, whatever it was 5 days before that. Who comes out of the woodwork? The dead guy's mother. And goes, cremation, oh no, the horror, the intentional infliction of emotional distress. Oh no, we don't do that in our family. Well, you know what, you can't sue the hospital because they didn't do anything wrong. You can't sue the sheriff for the performance of his official duties. You can't sue the judge for the performance of his official duties. Who's left? The funeral home. And they did it for free. And so in that Paul Harvey rest of the story part, when they go to the trial, it's the same judge, right? And he goes, oh yeah, you're right. I didn't have authority to sign that order. Sorry. So $60,000 award to Mama. At least that much to my colleagues, because, you know, they're not cheap dates. And so as a result of that, cremation in Virginia, if they bury you at Arlington with the case on and everything, and that was not what you wanted, they can fix that. But if they cremate you and that is not what you wanted, oops, so they now want all of your next of kin of your same degree of relation to sign off. So spouse, No spouse, they want all of your children. Now, and it's not majority rules, it's all of your children. So I had a lady that I was guardian for who had, she was in her 90s, she was the youngest of 19 children. She had never married and she had no kids. Shockingly, her parents were gone. Most of her, all of her siblings had predeceased her. She had 116 nieces and nephews, or great nieces or nephews of the closest degree of consanguinity. Huh. So instead, she was not cremated. First Presbyterian of Arlington had a couple of plots over at National Memorial in Falls Church, and Murphy's Funeral Home in Arlington donated a fully depreciated rental casket. Rental casket. I had never heard of that. That's where you want to have a viewing, but you, and then cremation. But it was fully depreciated. And I reached into my own pocket for, you know, $1,500 to, like, just please bury this lady because I can't find 116 people and explain it. Like, the postage alone to write to them, I might as well have. So, you know, the estate stuff's pretty clear. The thing I worry about the most, though, is while you're alive and making sure that you have designated who you want to have help you if you need help. Unfortunately, a big part of my practice is doing guardianships for people who have not made their arrangements. And that, by this I mean powers of attorney for financial matters and for healthcare matters. My number one goal is to keep my clients off TV. No, Terry Schiavo, like, we're not doing that. You know, all those cases that come on TV, on the news, about people fighting about healthcare decision making, those are miserable, those are heartbreaking, and I make a fortune off those cases. And that is, frankly, how I would rather not make money. I had a case, a lady named Lucille. Lucille was, she was the happy, confused, elderly lady with dementia, but happy, smiley. She had five kids. And these five kids love their mother. Love their mother. They hate each other more than they love their mother, however. So they got into dispute about who was going to be in charge. And it ended up in a courtroom. I was not in this courtroom. I was not involved in this case. And the judge finally said, a pox on all your houses. We're going to get a nice, independent, third-party lawyer who will deal with this. And for some reason, my name just sprung to mind. It's either that or one of my colleagues, you know, tossed my name, threw me under the bus. I don't know. And so I served as guardian for Lucille for several years, where these kids, you know, and I mean they're kids, they're like in their 60s, right? All I'm doing is organizing visitation. And when Lucille died, I was so happy that, honestly, I did something. They called me. It was a Saturday afternoon. I was at home. My phone rings. I pick it up. It's the hospital, and they tell me that Lucille has passed. And I said, oh, thank you so very much. I hung up the phone, and I danced the Macarena, right? Because I don't have to deal with these kids anymore. That Lucille is at peace, and maybe I, too, will have some small measure of peace in my life. But you know what? That's not how it turned out. So here's this is great. So they're different camps of kids, right? And so there's two girls on this side, two girls on this side, and the poor brother who just wants nothing to do with any of them. He just, and two of the girls, and the one who's named the executor, they go to Murphy's funeral home. I know why Barry Murphy got out of the business. It was this case. They made all the arrangements to have mom, big funeral, St. Charles in Arlington, ship the body to Minnesota to be buried next to her husband. And as soon as, and it was all lovely and they were all nice to each other. And then this one says, okay, well now we've made all the arrangements. You two can go. I'm the one who has to do the paperwork and pay for it, so I'll call you later. So these two leave. And this one goes, yeah, all that we just agreed to. We're not doing any of that. We're not doing any of it. Mom is going to be cremated. We're not going to have a service here. And we are, you're going to ship her ashes directly to the cemetery in Minnesota. When these two discovered this, they didn't take it that well. So you know what they did? They litigated for 9 weeks about who got to decide about Lucille's funeral arrangements. Where Lucille was denied the privilege of actually spinning in her own grave for 9 weeks. And they settled that case. They walked into the courtroom, and it was one of our elder statesmen, retired judges, who looked at this group coming in, and he says, huh, and then says to the clerk without covering up the microphone, you think I can lock them all up, or should we just assess fines against them individually? And the lawyers were smart enough to go, Your Honor, could we have just a minute? So that case could have, all of that was nonsense. It was expensive nonsense. My friend Jean got a new car out of that one. My friend Ken actually helped, just family fights like that has put all four of his kids through Ivy League education. So, honestly, if you think that stuff doesn't happen, it happens every day. And you look around at your friends, you look at your kids. This is a place where you can't afford to ignore issues. Because it's about you. When you're dead, I mean, honestly, what happens to your stuff and your will and all of that? My feeling on that is, you know what? Do what you want. You'll be dead. You don't have to listen to it. Right? But the things about while you're alive, who's controlling your money? Who's deciding where you're going to live? Right now, my dad, who is a retired lawyer, lives at Goodwin House. He and mom moved there 8 years ago. They're from Arlington, so they went to the one at Bailey's, not the one in Alexandria. And my mom died 5 years ago, and my dad in October ended up in the hospital, and we've now had to move him into the secured assisted living section. And it's amazing how my dad has everything beautifully organized. There, it's amazing. And my brother and I have been able to do whatever we needed to do. But this process has been so hard that I can't imagine, I who deal with this professionally and mock other people's families mercilessly, right? I can't imagine doing what we've had to do over the last 4 months, cleaning out apartments, sorting through all the family history, all of that. if we weren't in sync. And there are things that we don't agree on, but our parents were sufficiently clear with us that, and we've made a commitment that our relationship is more important than anything else, and that Dad's well-being is first. But you know what? Not everybody gets there. And so you've really got to have conversations with your family. Trust me when I tell you, everybody thinks their family feels like they do about healthcare stuff. Trust me when I tell you, that is not actually true. Have conversations. Tell them what you think. Tell them what you want. Your children generally do not want to discuss this stuff with you. And they say, oh, Mom, come on. Particularly, I find sons and mothers, you know, you get often this pushback of, you know, that's a long time from now. I don't want to talk about it. You don't need to deal with it. I now tell my clients to blame me. And I say, look, tell them you met with me and I said you have to do it. So I don't tell people to talk to their kids anymore. I now tell them to have a monologue at, you know, I met with a lawyer and she said I have to say this stuff. So I'm going to say what I need to say. And when we are done, we'll entertain your questions. And, you know, holidays are terrific for that. You know, when my mother died 5 years ago, she had a terrible blowout stroke. And as we were at Virginia Hospital Center walking down the hallway to that room where you talk with doctors about stuff you don't want to talk about, we're walking down the hall, and it's me, my older brother Bill, and Dad. And my brother turns to me and he goes, well, he smacks me. Right? Smack. You remember Mom at Thanksgiving that time? What? What? And he said, you know, and gave me a little clue. And I went, oh, yeah, I do. And my father, what are you kids talking about back there? Dad, you remember Mom at Thanksgiving, what she said that time? No. Little reminder. Oh. We walk into that room, and my dad puts his hand down on the table. We all in. I said, may I? Yes. We are taking Mom home with hospice right now, today. We're done. And the doctor there goes, that's great. That's what I would recommend. But I want to know now, what is it that your mother said? And what happened at Thanksgiving? What happened at Thanksgiving? 5, 6, 8, 10 years before, we don't really remember exactly when. But my dad practiced this kind of law, and we talked about this stuff. And it is possible that there was some wine involved in this conversation. But my mom said, look, you let me end up laying in a bed staring at the ceiling, and you're going to be fine as long as I'm alive. But the minute I'm dead, I'm going to come back and drag you to the eighth ring of hell. Okay. And, you know, that, well, said in jest, she meant that. And the gift that was for us, the gift to know that when we had to make that call, it was not us projecting. It was implementing the choice she would make for herself if she could sit up and say. And we took that, Mom had that stroke on Tuesday. We had this conversation on Wednesday. We took her home on Thursday, and she died peacefully on Sunday, surrounded by her children and grandchildren. And it was as good as it could be. And then we had a big old Presbyterian funeral over at Little Falls with good old Presbyterian hymns, and which she had selected all on her own, and not the ones I would have picked. So, anything. All right. Well,
so,
yes.
The funeral is for...
Well, well, here's the thing. I think the funerals are absolutely for the living. But what I can tell you what I see is people are desperate to do what the dearly departed wanted them to do. And so giving them some guidance, like we could have said, well, I really hate that one. But it's not, to me, in that case, for me, it was, I knew that these were songs she loved. So, yeah, people, I mean, I think.
I'm going to talk a little bit about health care wishes, like all alive, and I don't want that kind of doctor want this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm dealing with that right now.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, as long as you can speak for yourself, the documents you write are not worth the paper they're written on. However, the biggest issue, I mean, how many HIPAA privacy waivers have you signed? Like every time you go to the doctor now, you have to sign another HIPAA waiver thingy. So I think the big issue is deciding who you can rely on to assist you with healthcare, and being clear that the documents, the legal documents, are just the legal shield that you hold up and say, your agent holds up and says, you talk to me. Like, she can't do it. So you talk to me. The real interesting bit is what is it that you want them to say? Because the two parts are who's going to speak for me and what do I want them to say? The what do I want them to say part, is your documents can say do A, B, C, 1, 2, 3. But if your agent says, no, we're not doing that, they're not doing that. So the selection of your agent is the vital part. Yeah.
I was in Alexandria Hospital, and I had signed a thing saying my wife was permitted to visit me and to act on my behalf.
Mm-hmm.
2 o'clock in the morning, this nurse came in, shoved a paper in front of me, told me something that I didn't know what she was saying, and I signed it. And the next morning, what we came to find out was I had withdrawn that
consent
in the middle of the night without knowing it. That happened in Alexandria Hospital.
Wow. So, wow, that's crazy. Yeah, there are some big problems with that. And I'd be happy to give you the name of the hospital's counsel and his cell phone number. There are problems with that. And that, you know, one of the things that we see is hospitalization is hard. The machinery continues to grind. You know, there's paperwork that has to be filled out. There are medical decisions that have to be made. There's, you know, and it is easy to just go along for the ride. And, I mean, I have people who get out of the hospital who can't really tell me why they were there. They don't. So when you're figuring out who can help you, and, you know, look, not everybody's got family that's appropriate to help them. Some people don't have family. Some people don't have family that's appropriate. There are lots of people to assist. professionals, like care managers, who can help navigate some of this stuff. But, you know, I have people who want to appoint their kids in birth order or whatever to, in their documents. And I always say in the healthcare, you've got to have somebody, there's nothing magical about a blood relationship, but you've got to have somebody who knows you well enough to know what you want, is willing to do that, is willing to implement that, and not have other belief systems about things. And frankly, a certain pain in the ass factor is a good thing, because they've got to be able to stand up to doctors and nurses and administration and other family members who don't like the choices that are being made. So, yeah, that's a disturbing story. Right. Yeah. Well, a revocation doesn't stick unless they tell the person that it's been revoked. Right. Right. But I mean, unless they tell you.
Oh, I see.
Because if you don't know, you continue to act under color of the authority that you have. So, right. So this is a problem I have with some of my clients, is they want to change their documents, but they don't want to tell their daughter. Because it'll hurt her feelings? Yeah, no, that's not how that works. I'll tell her. She can hate me for money. You can hate me. It's fine. I'm doing this for free, so be nice, you know. Yeah. So the thing that's important for him is to understand that the important part is saying who he wants to be able to make these decisions if he can't make them for himself. Okay. So the living will component, and I'll tell you, 15, 20 years ago, they all said the same thing. And they all said this. If the application of life-prolonging procedures will only serve to artificially prolong the dying process, I direct that such procedures or treatments be withheld or withdrawn. Okay, that doesn't say anything. Like, it turns out that was not helpful language, but we all wrote it for years. So now, and you're exactly right. Where the rubber meets the road these days in end-of-life decision-making is feeding tubes. And almost nobody puts a feeding tube in someone thinking it's going to be forever. You do it. I just had a client last week who had a throat injury. Yeah, she's got a feeding tube, but her throat's going to heal, and she'll be able to swallow. Now, our great-grandparents, if they couldn't swallow, they just died, right? But you don't have to swallow anymore. We can do that for you. And that whole Terry Schiavo case in Florida some years ago, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road. And in that case, you know, the husband, who was also her legal guardian, this woman was in a coma or a persistent vegetative state, had a feeding tube. That's how she was getting her hydration and nutrition. After X number of years, the husband said, I give, she's not getting better. I want to withdraw that because I think that feeding tube is like any other medical treatment. It's like antibiotics. It's like anything else that I can withhold or withdraw. And her family of origin didn't like that. And they didn't have a legal recourse, so they tried a political recourse. We had the same case here in Virginia a few years before. A newscaster by the name of Hugh Finn from Kentucky. He had been to his lawyers, but he hadn't come back to sign. He was in a terrible car accident. He was in a coma vegetative state. The whole family was in Manassas and Prince William, so they brought Hugh back to Virginia. And after a couple of years, his wife said, "I give. He's not going to get better. Pull the tube." The family of origin went nuts. Governor Gilmore and Delegate Bob Marshall got involved and called this a right to life issue, and they got involved on the side of the family of origin. My current law partner, she and her then law partner represented the wife, and they litigated for months and eventually won the right to remove the tubes, and Hugh died. That case was so upsetting for the previous law partner, Gary, that he quit the practice of law, went to seminary, and is now a Methodist minister in Springfield. So back to your question, it's why who you select has to know you well enough to be able to do the analysis that you would do for yourself. Yes. And if you don't have a healthcare agent designated, the Great Commonwealth of Virginia has done that for you as well. So there's a list in the law under the Healthcare Decisions Act of who gets to make your healthcare decisions if you can't. First is the person you appoint under a power of attorney. Second is a court-appointed guardian. Your spouse is third. Adult children, fourth. Parents, siblings. This is Virginia, so it goes down to eighth cousins twice removed. You know, just next of kin. If you're going to rely on that, please make sure you have an odd number of children. Yeah. Yeah. Because here's why. In reality, from a purely legal perspective, no. But from a pragmatic, real perspective, I'm the doctor, and I walk into this waiting room, and there are all these relatives, and everybody's upset, right? Because something really bad has happened. And you say, "I'm the healthcare agent. Pull the plug." And all of these people say, "Oh, no, I'm not ready. Oh, no, he's going to get better." And I look at everybody and I go, "Wait, which one can sue me?" "Oh, you. I'm going to do what you say." Because the lawyers, like me, have made the doctors, like them, afraid of everything. And they really have to look at who has the legal authority to enforce. And the person who has the legal authority to enforce is you. So it is difficult and expensive and time-consuming. You can litigate. The rest of them can say, "No, no, he gave very specific instructions. And if you saw what he told her, you'd know she's doing the wrong thing." But I've seen those cases a few times, but generally they don't get anywhere. They're very expensive. They're very expensive cases. So you can say who can speak for you. It's near on impossible to enforce what you've told them to say. That's why it's important that you pick the person who will do it. To enforce the instructions that you've been given. So if you are given instructions that say, let me go, and you, the agent, say, I'm not ready. I'm not ready to let him go. Keep him on life support. I'm not ready. They will keep him on life support. No matter how clear. I mean, he can have do not resuscitate tattooed on his chest, and this has happened. And if the person making that decision says, I'm the legal decision maker, and I know it says do not resuscitate, but I'm telling you, do it. They will do it. Yeah, you just died. Right? People just died. Yeah. Well, and I'll tell you, like, for our Roman Catholic friends, Pope Benedict issued a bull to clarify that after the Terri Schiavo case, I did nothing but write healthcare directives for months. That's all I did. And so many people came in and they would say, I want one that's in conformance with the teachings of my church. And I would go, that's great. What is that? And they go, I don't know. Presbyterians, Episcopalians, Catholics, Mormons, Jews, no, I don't know. So it became my job to find out. And so I was working on a case at the time about a Cardinal Worrell of Washington, was the Archbishop of Pittsburgh at the time, and he and I had a case together about his sister. We were on opposite sides of this case. But we got to be friends, so I called him up, and I said, Don, I have all these great, nice Roman Catholics who are coming to my office, and they want a directive that's in conformance with the teachings of the church. And he said, oh, that's great. I said, yeah, they don't know what that is. And you could hear him, like, banging his head on his desk. It was actually a very nuanced position, and it says, as Christians, death is not something that we fear. We believe that there is something beyond, and that it's going to be better than what we have now. And life is precious, though. It is a gift from God, and we need to safeguard it. But we don't need to be nutso about it. So we need to do all the regular and ordinary things. But we are never called to do anything that is extraordinary. So the problem is no doctor will ever say that anything he or she does is extraordinary. So what Pope Benedict clarified was on feeding tubes for Roman Catholics that you never, never, never have to put a feeding tube into somebody because that is always extraordinary. But if you do that, and it becomes the means by which food and water are delivered. Food and water are never extraordinary. They are always an ordinary, everyday thing. So once you start, you can't stop. You can't withdraw that without having a really good reason, like it's causing pain or infection or... Fortunately, we are Presbyterians, and we don't have those constraints, right? We don't have any of that. Yes, sir?
Question. We all have a right of will, have a written name and executive executive. But in the case of those decisions that you talked about, let's say we have four children, is there anything wrong with stipulating in the cases of disagreement, majority will rule,
Fine. That's fine. We it's probably better to name The coin flipping is complicated because it's often not a binary choice. So my advice would be, because you were not smart enough to have an odd number of children, the majority rule thing, that works great.
We fail.
Well, you could just get rid of one. It'd be fine. Or buy a china cabinet. You might designate some other person as the tiebreaker, because then you've got another witness. Yeah.
I'd like to ask about a different situation, just my personal, but it might apply to other people too. There's so many people that think of having dementia these days. And I have a friend who has it, but she's working with a doctor to stay at, you know, mm-hmm. hopefully overcome it, but this doctor does not use drugs for that. Now, her family is very pro-drug, but my friend knows her sister's in a nursing home, and if there were some drugs to help her, she wouldn't be there. So she's coming to me. What do I tell them? I don't want this. I don't want to be in the middle of this. And I did think the other day, what if she does get worse? Should she do some kind of legal document to stipulate she does not? I mean, they're trying to put her on drugs for everything you can.
Absolutely, because here's what, if she doesn't say who's going to be her decision maker now while she can. Right. Right, but it needs to be documented, and she needs to appoint someone to be her agent who will enforce that. Because if she doesn't, her family is going to default to them, and they're going to do what they think is best for her rather than what she would choose for herself. Well, everybody would, but not everybody's got $200,000 a year.
Yeah, but if these people do.
If they do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because some people say, I would rather save the money for my family and go to a facility. Most people don't, but most people would. I mean, everybody would rather stay in their own home, right? The reason people go to facilities is because they are less expensive than, by far, than the cost of providing in-home care. So, all right. Well, I'm happy to hang out, but it's time now.
Terry Schiavo became ill.
Mm-hmm. Terry Schiavo had a heart attack.
Oh, she did.
She had a cardiac event.
How old was she?
30.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh.
Well, wonderful. So. Thank you very much.